You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows at castaway.media or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/castawaypodcasts.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Bookish, the podcast about books coming from Dublin in Ireland with me, Shane Breslin from Blackbird Books in Navan, County Meath.
And myself, Bob Johnston of the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar and Dalkey.
And this is the special winter May bank holiday edition. It's the bank holiday weekend, May bank holiday weekend, and we are all wrapped up warm. It's hailing outside. Winter just seems to go on and on.
That's it. You know, you can't beat a good Irish spring of blizzards and hail, can you really? What more could you ask for?
Yeah, four seasons in one day and most of them winter, yeah. kicking into straight in the news, Bob, we have a few news items that come up. It's been a short month. For any of our regular listeners, it's been a short month because we were late with April and we're kind of on time for May. But a couple of newsy items that came up over the last couple of weeks. Suzanne O'Sullivan winning the Welcome Book Prize recently.
Yeah, so Suzanne O'Sullivan she's originally from Ireland. I believe she lives over and works over in London these days. She's a consultant neurologist. Indeed. And she won the £30,000 sterling Welcome Book Prize for her debut, It's All in Your Head, which is a non-fiction book describing her journey through the world of psychosomatic illness. The Welcome Book Prize celebrates the best new books for the year of 2015, basically 1st of January to end of December 2015, that engage with some aspect of medicine, health or illness, and kind of show how medicine kind of goes throughout fictional and non-fictional work. So yeah. It's an interesting prize. It's always an interesting shortlist, actually, and it's great to see an Irish person win it.
And there's been so many along this. I think it's quite a newish prize. I think it's the Wellcome Trust in the UK. The 30,000 sterling prize fund is starting to be welcome for Susanna Sullivan, I'm sure. There's been so many really, really good kind of medical books over the last couple. I'm thinking back even to The Emperor of All Maladies, things like that, over the last few years. It's an interesting prize to put together, rewarding books, new books, fiction or non-fiction in the field of medicine and health. So congratulations to Susanna Sullivan on that. The Hennessy New Irish Writing Award has been. The prizes have been dished out this week. Rhianna Judge McCormick, I think, got the overall prize. She has plenty of pedigree. I think she's a granddaughter of Michael Judge, who was a multi award winning playwright back in the day. Wrote lots and lots of plays, radio plays. Wrote for Glen Rowe and the Reardons and various things. So Rhianna has had a good year so far. The Hennessy New Irish Writing Prize, or the New Irish Writer of the Year, I think is the title. She's also won the Gallybegger Press Short Story Prize earlier in the year, so it's been a really, really good couple of months for Rhianna Judge McCormick. Previous winners of the Hennessy Award include Sarah Baum last year, and then back earlier a few years ago, Joseph O'Connor, Colin McCann. So best of luck to Rhianna Judge McCormick. It'll be interesting to see where she goes next.
Yeah, certainly the Hennessy Awards are very much seen as a first step towards something big, if
very
you see what I mean.
So,
they seem to be very good at picking people with great potential who can then go on and produce something that sells incredibly well for bookshops, because as bookshop owners, we love something that sells incredibly well. And as you say, we saw it last year with the Sarah Bowne, who went on to write Spill Simmer Falter Wither, which we've talked about here, which is just one of the best novels of last year completely. So yeah, very exciting. Other ones to mention: the emerging fiction winner was Chris Connolly, and the emerging poetry winner was Jane Clark, and Eilish de Gwivner was inducted into the Hennessy Hall of Fame as well, that's their award for kind of the established area with a body of work. So it was the 45th year of those last night, so that's one of those prizes that's been going on, and I think the reason it stays so good is because they always seem to pick good winners.
And it must be said, to hats off as well to the Irish Times, who have been putting in their pages for the last couple of years. It had several different different homes for different times. I think it was in the Tribune going way back, the Irish Press, I think, were back in the day. But I think there was a bit of a to and fro about where they would actually get the the new works published in newspaper format. And the Irish Times stepped up to market, I think, about a year or so ago. So it's fantastic to see that. The next news item there was the Book Industry Awards, which takes place in early May.
That's right. Book Industry Awards are kind of, as it says, an industry award. So they're kind of more relevant to us in a way within the industry. They don't get pushed outwards so much. But they are important in terms of recognising the work goes on in producing books. They cover everything from editor of the year, foreign sales agents, publishers,
kind of
book distribution.
Yeah.
So all the jobs that are involved in bringing those books out. Obviously, there are things like novel of the year as well. So things that people would be more used to. They take place on the 9th of May over in London.
There are
some Irish shortlistees this year. So we always have our fingers crossed. The Green Road by Anne Enright is up for Fiction Book of the Year. The Blessington Bookstore down in Wicklow are up for Independent Bookshop of the Year. Something, actually, the Gutter Bookshop's been shortlisted before, and it's always great to see an Irish shop in there.
Janet as well, Janet Hawkins, who was really, just to give Janet a mention, Janet's fantastic, she was great. Before we opened Blackbird Books, both Bob to my left and Janet were really, really good and really forthcoming with advice and help. And Janet's till is still in our shop. She lent us a till.
We've announced it now. She'll be after that. She'll be claiming. She wondered where that had gone. There we are. Other shortlistees, Eason's are up for Children's Bookseller of the Year, and Debray Books are up for Book Retailer of the Year. So again, it's great to see the Irish shops in there getting a good mention at the Book Industry Awards. So best of luck to everybody who's nominated for those.
Fantastic. Moving on to our book club, Bob, and this was your pick this month.
It is. We covered last month that The Glorious Heresies by Lisa McInerney has been shortlisted for the Bailey's Prize for Fiction, which is a prize celebrating fiction written by women. And Lisa McInerney has been much talked about in the last year or so since this book originally came out. It is a debut novel set in Cork, and I was trying to think how best to describe it, because actually I find it a difficult one to describe. I think I decided it kind of told the stories of kind of the Cork underclass in a way, everything from prostitutes, junkies, dealers, homeless people, all of that kind of things,
and gives
voices to these people, and boy does it give voices to them.
It really does. It's a huge, to give it a bit of a story, there's four or five key characters here, and the main character that starts with is Ryan, who's a 15-year-old who's skirting the law. He's really, really intelligent and clever and does really, really well at school, but he's found his way onto the underbelly of society, and he's dealing drugs in school at the age of 15, and kind of making strides in the underground of Cork. But it's a hugely confident debut. I've never met Lisa, but I've known her for a long time through Twitter and online, and she used to write a blog called The Arse End of Ireland several years. I don't think it's before Twitter and Facebook really grew, so it's a good few years ago now. And it was an amazingly well written blog. It was must read stuff for loads of people back then. So it was no surprise to me to see a novel landing on the shelves, and to see the acclaim with which it has been met over the last 12 months or so. Cork literary, the Cork has such a strong literary tradition, but it's very, very different from what we're seeing here. Going back to the days of Sean O'Fale and Frank O'Connor, all of that. Interestingly, over the last week or so, I read Kevin Barry's essay in Granta on Cork.
Okay.
If you haven't read that, you should dig it out, because it's a really, really good companion piece almost to the McInerney book. There's some incredibly brilliant lines. It's a very filmic book. Like, I could easily see this being like the film options. I'm sure publishers are selling or hawking out film options of this, because it could easily land on your screens as a big budget action movie set down beside the Lee. Some great lines, like, you know, she describes a counselor at one stage as a right old man's arse in a skinny shirt with a nose only just long enough to look down. And Maureen, one of the characters, the gangster's mother, Maureen, she's confessing over the murder. The murder that happens in the first couple of pages. And she's in a confessional and she says that she was talking to the priest. She says, God is great that way. He has massive ears and a mouth sewn shut. So there's brilliant, brilliant lines.
You really do get to feel she loves language and loves playing with words and constructing sentences. And it really, the dialogue, but also the descriptions, I think somebody else says, you know, they really fizz. There's kind of such an energy behind it, you know, and it's kind of nonstop. I have to be completely honest. I got a bit lost in places. I got a bit confused between characters. I don't know if I was just trying to read it too quickly or perhaps too slowly. I don't quite know. But I found it confusing in places. There was so much going on and I wasn't sure always who was talking and who about, and that. So I did find it get a bit lost.
I just kind of share that in a little bit of a way. That there was a couple of kind of time jumps that didn't seem to me to add up. I felt I could have done with an edit, actually. I think there was a few lines in here that just seemed a little bit overstretched, and it could have been tightened up a little bit. But yeah, overall, I really, really enjoyed it. And to be fair, I think there's better to come from these. I think she's a really, really great writer. It's a very, very accomplished debut. It's in the running for, as I said, the Bailey's Prize. Which would be an amazing achievement to win that with your first novel, but yeah, I think there's going to be better to come from her.
Yeah, and I agree. I thought it was a fantastic debut, and you know, she is just such got that kind of raw talent that you can just see is just going to shine through. So
can I have a little bit of a rant? I see you have the same edition that I have, which is the big format trade paperback, which it's out now in the small mass market, the regular edition.
In a bright orange.
Really nicely designed. But the price point, I'm not sure, as a bookseller, how does this stack up for you in the gutter? Because we had this in the shop when it came out. I was really looking forward to it. We had it in the shop when it came out last year. But it's £15 on the back. It was kind of 19, 20 euro was the asking price. And it's just very, very hard to shift. And I just think that I think different publishers do this in different ways. But for me, maybe it's just the location of us. Maybe it's our customer base. But I think this is a really, really struggle to sell a large format trade paperback.
Certainly as a bookshop, and we talk about it a lot, obviously a lot of books are published over in the UK originally and are bought over sterling into euro. And when the exchange rate goes a bit crazy, it has done over the last kind of year.
Indeed, yeah.
And prices fluctuate all over the place and you've got to make your call. Some of certainly the trade paperbacks, as we call them, the large format paperbacks, come in very expensive, and it's very hard to justify to a customer why you're charging 20 or 21 euro for a paperback book, and they quite rightly complain to you about it. So and certainly for debuts, I think debuts, when you want to get them out and reach the biggest audience you can to build up that following, do need to be priced accordingly. Now, you know, it's always difficult. We're independents. You may find it half price somewhere or whatever, where they've done a special deal, but it makes it very hard. For what I would see is, you know, we promoted this as one of our must reads when it first came out, because it is a must read. It's an exciting new Irish talent. You must read her. You must get in there and give it a look. So your rant is well placed, Shane.
Oh, thank you. That's directed at not at least of other people. that's our book club pick for this month, was Lisa McInerney's The Glorious Heresies, which is out now in small form of paperback.
At a nice price point. Exactly.
The book club for next month, the book club pick for next month is my choice, and I am going for, just to make sure I have it here in front of me, The Hurley Maker's Son by Patrick Deely. We're going for a bit of memoir, a bit of non-fiction. I don't know if we've done much of that in our book club picks over the last... the first eight or nine episodes of Bookish, but that's the one we're going for this month. So if you'd like to read along and tweet us at Bookish Podcast, it would be great to hear your thoughts.
Indeed,
on
look
The
forward
Hurley
to
Maker's
that.
Son by Patrick Deely. Trilogy is the part of the show where we bring in a special guest from the world of books or thereabouts to talk about three books that mean lots to them, to talk through those. Today we have a first-timer behind the mic, so we'll go easy on him.
Thanks.
Ricochet, thanks very much for coming in.
How's it going? Thank you for having me, and then you bring me in out of the warmth. What you guys don't realise, obviously, listening to the podcast, is while we're recording this, it's hailstoning outside, and you've brought me into a warm room. It's great. It's a good start.
Absolutely, yeah. Before we kick into your three books, Rick, we might have a chat about you and books, because you've become synonymous with books over the last couple of years. Poetry Show, the Ricochet Book Club, loads of other things going on. Anytime there's a public interview with somebody in the world of the books now, it seems to be you that's doing it. Where did this obsession come from?
It's weird. I never thought, I had this conversation with somebody last night, I never thought this whole reading books thing would pay off, and it just did. Do you know what? I've spent my life being a reader from the time I was a kid, and you know, like everybody else, you just go, you read, you find things you like, and you talk amongst your mates and you have all that. And then a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, a little bit more now, I made the foolish decision of deciding I was going to read 100 books in a year, just for kicks. I was going through a patch of, as many people do, realizing that I was reading maybe 20 books a year, maybe 15, and doing that whole thing of every time I went into a bookstore hyperventilating because there were so many things I really would love to read. And then you get slightly older and you realize, oh, hang on, I'm going to die before I've read all the books I want to read. So I went, right, 100, let's see how that pans out. And I did it. And in order to keep myself honest at the time, I said, right, I've got to say it in front of other people. So I wrote a blog about it. And I talked about it on radio, and it became a thing that other people then start talking to you about books, because they don't realise that you read books, even though you're a human being and everybody, you know, reads books. So that happened, and then it started conversations with other people, and then people started going, why don't you have a book club? You should, that's a really great idea. Why don't we'll, you know, you can recommend things and we'll do stuff. And I figured out Facebook was the easiest way to do it. So I went, okay, here's I'm setting up shop here. Anybody wants to come in, you're more than welcome to. And there's almost 3,000 people there now, 18 months later, which is bonkers, which is crazy. And it's become something that originally I thought, I'll recommend a book once a month, and then people will come back to it later when I do. And now I have almost no involvement in it, because people just hop in and all start talking about either stuff they're reading or recommendations for genre or any of this. And then you start getting asked to do stuff, and you start getting asked to, you know, do public interviews and to launch people's books for them, and people see you at that and they go, oh, he's not bad, he'll be okay. And then there, and you know, so it rolls, it just starts all rolling downhill. That's a very bad metaphor, but you know, that's what happens.
Yeah, fantastic. We kick into your three books, Rick, and the three, as generally happens in this slot, we get three very, very different books, and I think when in talking to you in advance, you said it was quite a task to whittle it down into three. 1984, George Orwell, I think, is the first one you've brought to us today.
Yeah.
Why?
Firstly, I think if you'd asked me on a completely different day, you might have gotten a completely different set of books. Mm. And I did. I had to go away and go, okay, hang on. If I'm gonna only pick three, which three is it going to be? I don't know. Orwell, like most other people, I came across Orwell probably for the first time doing my intercert at the time, because Animal Farm was on the curriculum. And Animal Farm, it's probably, I mean, maybe I was a late bloomer for this kind of thing, one of those late things where you realise subtext running underneath something that's happening, which is ostensibly a story about talking animals and about how they're all nasty to each other. And once the subtext of it is explained to you, you go, oh, that's really clever, okay. And I just probably grabbed 1984 at the time fairly soon off. And like most people who, when you read 1984 for the first time, your brain explodes. And in particular, the further on I seem to go in life, the more real life becomes like 1984. Mm. And then you realise what a special book it is, particularly for something that was written just after World War II. And it's not just about how, there's always that chicken and egg question about whether or not Orwell wrote this and it has influenced the world that has gone on after it, or whether or not he was just very prescient and saw what was about to come down the line. And every time you read 1984, you get something new out of it. It's a very easy book to pick. It was my immediate first choice.
Do you think modern kind of teenagers coming to it now, because in a way, 1984 seems quite tame now due to some of the stuff that, you know, is coming out of the woodwork now and the kind of society that we live in. And do you think it still has the same effect? Is it 1984 dated by 20 years?
I don't know. I think that obviously dystopia is the new mainstream. So, you know, dystopias are everywhere, both in mainstream fiction and particularly in YA as well. So you're right. It's something kids are used to from the get-go.
One of my favourite questions from the bookshop, somebody came up to and said, well, which is your favourite dystopia? Which is a nice question to be asked.
What was your answer?
I couldn't possibly choose a dystopia that's special to me.
I couldn't choose the end of the world that appeals to me most. The honest answer is I don't know. And I do have that moment, though, and the last time I read it was about 3 years ago, I had that moment of going, there is a possibility that if you come to it cold and you've never read 1984 before, you might think, oh, this is all a bit old hat. Mm. You do have to chronologically scroll everything back in your head and go, 1949. Mm. It was published just after World War II. I only read the history of it quite recently as well. He was on a Scottish island. He was essentially consumptive at the time. He was ill and on a Scottish island scribbling this whole insane, wonderful story down. And you have to think what a bombshell that was at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And everything it has influenced from there on in as well, because you see so many other books that feel influenced from it. And even then, you go back and read, I don't know if either of you have ever read, this is going to get nerdy now, Yevgeny Zamyatin's
I was just about to bring it up.
which is allegedly the book that Orwell took inspiration from. And I only read that for the first time a couple of years ago, because it's hard enough to come by. And it is. There are huge elements of 1984 in it, but it's just not as entertaining. It's quite dull in places, and it doesn't have that same clean, straight narrative that you get from Orwell.
I think for some reason, I don't ask me why, but I read Zamyatin first because it was on the... I didn't get to 1984 till my 20s, and Zamyatin was on the curriculum that I had in UCD. Okay. So I got to that one first, and I really, really enjoyed that. But and I can't remember. I think it might have been written before, was it?
It was written long
before, and banned for years and years, I think. So maybe it didn't come out for ages. But
certainly banned in Russia and banned by the Soviets as well. You don't want to go talking about that kind of thing.
No, definitely not. No, I think we've moved a little bit beyond that. I don't know. With Donald Trump and Putin, who knows? We could be going way back there.
Oh, God, don't depress me on a day like today. I was having a nice time up there.
Your second book, Rick, is Richard Dawkins, right?
Yeah. So
moving on from the sublime to ridiculous, no?
Ooh. This is where, whenever you mention the God delusion, it becomes contentious. I, for most of my adult life, was a confirmed agnostic. I was somebody who was brought up Catholic and had all the rituals done and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, my mum never really brought us to Mass after that. You know, you go every couple of weeks. It was fine. It was a thing you had to do. You felt like it. And I suppose it would have been different if I'd lived in a rural setting. I mean, it's very different if you live in a small town. Everybody notices if you don't go to Mass. But, you know, I grew up in Crumlin, so our church was huge. Nobody really would have noticed if anyone was there. And the further on I got in life, the more I thought, agnostic, that'll do me. There might be some sort of great spiritual power. There might be something happening. And, you know, you convince yourself that there are things that happen in your life that must have been the action of some supreme whatever. And then I went on my honeymoon in 2012, and I brought a couple of books with me, and Dawkins was one of them. And by the time I'd finished the end of it, I was enraged. I was angry at everything, mostly myself, for having spent my entire life going, because all he does in The God Delusion, if you've never read it, is asks a bunch of incredibly simple questions and says, why on earth do you believe in any of this nonsense if there's no proof for anything? Just give me a shred of anything, a tiny smidge of proof, just one thing. Give me something that's real. And then you do have to put your hands up and go, yeah, it's probably all nonsense, isn't it? Fair enough. You feel a bit like Dougal and Father Ted. And then you have that moment going, ah, well, fair enough. And so since then, you know, it was that moment when I went from agnostic to atheist. And it's strange, when we're recording this, I'm about to make it my book club book of the month for next month. I'm not going to make it the only book. I'm going to give people an option, because it does. It divides people, even the conversation about reading something like that. It becomes very contentious. So I will give people an opt-out, but I'm really fascinated to see where it goes with a bunch of people in a book club.
Absolutely. Have you dipped into that one, Rob?
I haven't. I've done events with Richard Dawkins. And the most intriguing thing, and I don't know why this always sticks with me, at the events I did with Richard Dawkins, he gets his wife to read passages from the book. And his wife used to be one of the assistants on Doctor Who.
Ooh.
I know. And this is fascinating because she was a trained actress. Now, I presume they're still together. I must admit, this was a good 15 years ago or so. But I was so obsessed with meeting one of the assistants of Doctor Who that I kind of sidelined
Far more
Richard
important
Dawkins.
Than Dawkins, yeah.
Way
yeah.
more important. There you are. But no, I agree. It's a really interesting book and a very well written book. And he does like to stir the pot, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, some of the things he comes out with, since The God Delusion, in fairness, the last couple of years have been...
Oh, he should stay on Twitter.
Yeah, you know, he has a habit of enraging people. But the book itself, and exactly, would be a very interesting one to talk about. And I'm intrigued, obviously, I grew up in England, and I would have been labelled as C of E, Church of England, but again, my parents not interested in religion in any way. My dad was a confirmed atheist by the end of his life, and I pretty much am as well, if you see what I mean. So, but it's particularly interesting in an Irish setting, obviously, because of the strength of the Catholic Church I've had in the past. So I can imagine it's actually a lot more contentious here than it is back in England where it was written.
I think it depends on which generation you're talking about. I think, you know, if you're under 30, it's people look at it and go, oh yeah, well, that's fair enough. If you're of a certain generation, obviously, it's essentially like putting, you know, a burning book into your hands that's going to flay your skin off.
Yeah, and I suppose as time goes on, it certainly loses power, I imagine.
And the thing about Dawkins as well is he's a great gateway drug to people like Christopher Hitchens, and then next thing you know, you're down the rabbit hole and you start reading a lot of other really good stuff off the back of it. So it's a nice in for stuff like that.
Dawkins as gateway drug, I love it. The last book you brought, so again, very, very different, Audrey Niffenegger,
yes.
The Time Traveller's Wife. Why this one?
Because I wanted something soppy and something that made me cry. Because there's no point in going in and having, you've got, you know, and you do feel like balancing. So I came in at the end of this. Mainly because when I read it for the very first time, I thought, what an elegantly put together story, which obviously reflects, and it's only afterwards you read it, it reflects events that happened in her life and in her own relationships. But she sets it in this extraordinary constraint of, if you never read The Time Traveller's Wife, and no spoilers, a man who is Henry has what they call chrono impairment. So it's ostensibly a science fiction story, but he keeps disappearing to different points in the past and future. He has no control over where he goes. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator, he wakes up and appears naked wherever he is. He has no clothes, he has no money, no anything, and he can disappear anywhere back and forth in time and has no control over it. And this is about the woman who ends up having a relationship with him and falling in love with him, and how they meet each other at various different points in their lives. And it's not an easy book in places. It's not a soppy book. It's not what you'd call chick lit by any stretch of the imagination. And it's, you know, at the end of it, by the time you get there, you do go, God, yeah, it, you know, I don't have an awful lot of books that make me feel that romantic, that this is a story, this is one of those great ones. And after I read The Time Traveller's Wife, I did, possibly because of where I was in my own life at the time. And then, you know, you end up reading it again and going, yeah, this is beautifully, beautifully put together.
It strikes me that the three books you've picked are all predate your 100 books a year escapade. Is it that you're reading so many now and you're struggling to get time to appreciate in retrospect, or have you come across books over the last few years that you've kind of, that could easily have slotted into this tree?
Oh no, I think you do. I think it is true that if you are sometimes reading too swiftly, that you do need times to digest books. Having said that, if you read a lot of books, there are certain things you read that don't really deserve being digested at all, and they're just nonsense and good luck, they're gone. No, I mean, in terms of even if stuff that I've read in the last 6 months, I read All the Light We Cannot See, Anthony Durr's book, which is one of the best things I've read in such a long, long time, and was a thing of a beauty that needed to be apportioned out in little doses. I was getting close to the end of it and going, I don't want to, I'm just...
I know, and they're very short chapters, aren't they? So it's the temptation to race ahead is huge. I must admit, I devoured it very, very quickly and then spent the rest of the year just talking about it to everybody who'd listened.
I just went online and started looking to see, was it possible to book, you know, rooms in St. Malo and to go and stay there for a couple of weeks and just go for wandering around the town. Or I read Sapiens, which essentially is an entire history of the human race, starting from the very beginning, but turns out to be one of those books that is about everything. It's about everything in life based on who the human race is, where we came from, and
see, you're cheating now. Your trilogy's gone to quintet.
I did ask the question.
And to be honest with you, you know, if you didn't have constraint on your podcast time, I could be here. So no, I suppose, like everybody, you do sometimes end up picking stuff that's older and you've had a longer relationship with when you're asked one of these pick three things stories.
Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, Rick. Thanks very much for coming in. Special guest on Trilogy this month was Ricochet.
And it is worth mentioning the Ricochet Book Club on Facebook yet again. It's something that I dip into quite a lot and have comments. I haven't had any raging arguments with anyone yet. Been very good.
Aren't they well-behaved?
But they are very well-behaved on there.
It is quite unusual for you, Bob. I've seen you on Facebook.
You are. I take a step back. There we are. But no, exactly. So well done on that, on bringing so many people into the bookish world. And thanks once again for joining us.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So you're very welcome back to Bookish, the books podcast from Dublin in Ireland. And next up, we're taking a second look, a look back at a classic or maybe a book that got missed first time around. And it's my job to pick one for this month. And I have gone for something we actually picked for our Classics Book Club in the Gutter Bookshop about a month, maybe 2 months ago. Somebody I didn't know, a book I'd never heard of, it came suggested to me, gave it a go, and I loved it. So the book that was chosen was Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont by Elizabeth Taylor. And this is the bit where you have to go, the other Elizabeth Taylor, because it's not the actress Elizabeth Taylor. God love her. I'm not sure she'd be up for writing this kind of fiction. So Elizabeth Taylor was a novelist kind of through the, I think she was through the kind of 1930s up to about the 1970s. She wrote 12 novels, as well as a lot of short stories, very well regarded at the time, and lots of people look back, but seems to have just kind of vanished off now. I think Virago publishers have brought back a number of her books back into print over the last few years. And Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont. So it begins, Laura Palfrey would have made a distinguished looking man and sometimes wearing an evening dress looked like some famous general in drag. There you are. So what a great start. That's, you know, so start, yeah. I mean, basically the synopsis of the story is Mrs. Palfrey, she's recently widowed. She moves into the Claremont Hotel in London as a new resident along a lot of other elderly residents who all seem to decamp, you know, to a hotel to live off their latter years, you know. And she has to find her kind of routine amongst all the other aging inhabitants. So, you know, one of the big things is that when the menu for the day's meal comes out, they all kind of cluster, because that's one of the few exciting points of the day, is to see what they'll be eating for dinner. So it's this very gentle kind of comedy, quite acidic, quite sharp as well. And it's actually very moving. It's about, you know, how people deal with old age, about family relationships. Mrs. Palfrey has an awful, awful daughter who really resents her mother still being alive and causing her, you know, worry in her own life, because God love her mother, you know, just being around causing. And she has this another awful grandson who resents having to come and visit his grandmother, because he lives in London as well. So he puts it off as long as he possibly can, but he knows he has to do it because he wants to keep his eye on the inheritance. So it's this very kind of harsh, quite cynical, but also very, very funny. And there's a bit of romance, you know, never too old for a little bit of romance, you know, that kind of thing.
Is it standard enough composition? Is it like, because if she's writing around that time, she managed to resist the kind of lure of kind of these crazy modernists who are about?
Yeah, no. This was written in 1970 or 1971, okay, right. And it's set in the 60s, so you get that feel of this whole new world that they're just not part of in any way, if you see what I mean. There's the younger ones are off, you know, doing their free love and smoking joints or whatever, but Mrs. Palfrey is holed up in the hotel with all the other elderly residents. So Anne Tyler, who's one of my favourite writers, described her as a soul sister to Jane Austen and Elizabeth Bowen. And sadly, Elizabeth Taylor, she didn't last long. This was published in 1971. She died in 1976, only at the age of 63 of cancer. So although she managed 12 novels, that was, you know, was plenty more to come. And I would highly recommend it. It's beautifully written, very clever and very insightful into getting older, but also so funny, also quite funny in a very dry kind of way. So that's my second look for this month, Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont by Elizabeth Taylor.
From second look to new look, new books on the shelves. You've picked out a few. We've both picked out a few. But what's catching your eye? That's coming.
I know I have a bucket load this month. May is one of those months where the new books kind of just explode everywhere. So I'll do some quick rattling through. I think so. Sam Blake, 17th of May. She has her first novel, Little Bones, coming out. Now Sam Blake is a pseudonym. That's what he says. A pseudonym for Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin, who's best known for her work on writing.ie.
And who we've had on the show.
And we have had on the show, you're right, one of our early guests here, which I'd forgotten about. Sorry, Vanessa.
So go back and listen to the archives of books.
There you are, see what I say. So her first novel, Little Bones, so it's based around Garda Kathy Connolly, investigating a break-in. She makes a gruesome discovery, an old wedding dress, and concealed in its hem a baby's bones. And then the dress's original owner, Lavinia Grant, is also found dead in a Dublin suburb. So crime fiction down the line, but Vanessa, or Sam Blake, as she's known for this book, Little Bones, shaping up to be sort of the start of a good new crime series.
And there was a really, really interesting blog about the process of finding a title for the book. I'm not sure if you've read that, but it was very fascinating, kind of the over and back, because they had settled on a title, and I think it surfaced somewhere else on another book, and there was a lot of there's an interesting blog. If you search for that, you'll find that. Your second pick is, and would have been one of my picks as well this month, Bob, is Mike McCormack's Solar Bones.
Yep, that's out actually next week, 5th of May. So Mike McCormack is a very well-regarded Irish writer. I think he's based over in Galway, if I remember
right.
He's over in the West, isn't he? Much anticipated, published by Tramp Press. So once a year on All Souls Day, it's said that the dead may return. Set against the looming financial crisis, Solar Bones looks how decisions ripple out in waves and how our morals are challenged in small ways every day. Hearing stunning things about this book. And the launch is actually in the Workman's Club this Thursday coming, the 5th of May, and we'll be down there selling books for it. So looking forward to hearing more on that one.
And I'll be down there probably buying books, so that's
a good deal.
Good deal for you. Good deal for both of us. I'm looking forward to that one now. Yeah, this is one of my books, the books I would have picked out at the start of the year that I was really looking forward to, as we've mentioned before, about Tramp Press. And Mike McCormack seemed a perfect fit for Tramp Press. He's somebody who's kind of been under the radar. I think it could be maybe 10 years since his most recent novel. He's had a couple of two or three books, but they've all gone a little bit under the radar. I think the Irish Times described him as kind of the most underrated Irish writer of his generation. So, and this one has been described as kind of an overlap between kind of Donal Ryan and Samuel Beckett, set in the west of Ireland. So, like, a really, really interesting and great advance word for that one. So, Mike McCormack's Solar Bones. My first pick this month, with Dermot Bulger, the prolific Dermot Bulger. There scarcely a year goes by now without a new book from Dermot Bulger. And his latest novel from New Ireland is called The Lonely Sea and Sky, which is a historical novel set on a ship coming from Wexford during World War II. It follows the fortunes of a young boy, and it really strikes me as interesting. Part of it is true to life. This ship did really exist, and it was it helped German warships that had been wrecked, I think, between Wexford and Spain and during World War II. So interesting to see how that one goes. But that's the Lonely Sea and Sky by Dermot Bulger, which is out soon from New Ireland.
Yeah, a couple more from me. Maggie O'Farrell's This Must Be the Place, released on the 17th of May. I read this about a month ago in an advanced copy, and I have to say it's the best book I've read this year so far. It's stunning. Love Maggie O'Farrell's writing anyway, but this, I think, is the best book that she's written. It's about a New Yorker living in the wilds of Ireland. He has children he never sees over in California, a father he loathes in Brooklyn, and her wife, Claudette, who is a reclusive ex-film star given to shooting at anyone who ventures up their driveway. It's fantastic. It is funny in places, but it's just absolutely stunning writing, and I just can't recommend it highly enough. So that's Maggie O'Farrell. The other one, Conor O'Callaghan, Nothing on Earth, is out a couple of days later, 19th of May. Conor O'Callaghan is a poet from Dundalk. He's not somebody I was familiar with in any way. And this is, I think, it's been called a novella. It's a short novel. There's nothing much, but it's early evening, the hottest August in living memory. A frightened girl bangs on a door, a man answers. From the moment he invites her in, his world will never be the same again. Again, hearing wonderful things about this one. I haven't read an advanced copy of this, but there's a good buzz about it. And I think you're looking at, you know, a new Donal Ryan kind of talent to be writing. So.
To finish with a couple of non-fiction books that I've caught my eye, they're coming on out on the shelves soon. Phil Knight, the guy who set up Nike back in the day, he's written a memoir about that process. It's called Shoe Dog. I think this started Nike, borrowed $50 off, $50 off his father to import some running shoes because he wasn't happy with the running shoes that were available, importing from Japan. So that's one, and it is one of these sterling, coming in from Sterling area. It's hardback, it's £20 sterling, so it's you might be
borrowing some money off your dad to buy it as well.
You borrow as much off your dad to buy it as he borrowed to start up Nike. Yeah, and the other one is David Reif. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I am. He's the son of Susan Sontag, the famous late literary critic, and he's written a book about called In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies, arguing that we should forget rather than commemorate, and it's kind of that we don't actually learn any lessons from historical mistakes. So it's kind of an interesting kind of slant on, especially in the year that we've had with Easter 1916, and we've had so much of it that I think a lot of people just want to forget about it at this stage. But yeah, there is some Irish. He's very close. He has close connections to Ireland as well. So there's some Irish chapters or definitely passages in there as well. So that's David Reif's In Praise of Forgetting: Historical Memory and Its Ironies.
And final two from me, Don DeLillo, who I love ever since I read Underworld about whatever it was 15, 20 years ago. Zero K is out on the 19th of May. I know nothing about it. I haven't seen any advanced information on this one at all. I just love his writing. One of the great American writers. It's great to see a new novel coming from him. And finally, back to a debut Irish novelist, Catherine Ryan Howard, Distress Signals. I think that's out 5th of May, so just within the next week or so. And I read this week it's already been optioned for a TV crime series by a company called Great Point Media, who do Doc Martin and Line of Duty and those kind of things. So obviously that's great news for her already. I'm hearing it's a very cleverly plotted thriller. Catherine Ryan Howard again is kind of quite big in the social media world, and wrote a non-fiction book before, but this is her first novel, so looking forward to Distress Signals from her on the 5th of May.
And that's so many new books. If you know of any new books that we should be keeping an eye on over the summer months, tweet us, get onto Twitter there and send us a tweet at Bookish Podcast. But that's our pick of the new books coming up for this month. We're drawn to the end of the 10th episode of Bookish. We've got to number 10, and we people hopefully are still listening.
Look at that, double digit figures. There we are.
It remains to, before we completely wrap up, just to draw your attention to some literary and bookish events happening around Ireland over the next few weeks.
Yeah, well, the big one for us this month is obviously the International Literature Festival Dublin, ILFD, as we like to call it for short. Used to be known as the Dublin Writers Festival. That takes place 21st to the 29th of May, with a specially early event on the 5th of May this week, in fact, with Jacqueline Wilson and Naomi Klein at the RDS. And it's based around where we are on Cowes Lane in Temple Bar over the two weekends of the 21st, 29th of May. Stack of literary events. We've got the Bookshop Band appearing as pop-ups in the gutter on the 28th and the 29th of May. But full information and tickets on ilfdublin.com.
And the Bookshop Band, clearly big fans of Bookish, because they're going to be coming to Blackbird Books as well on the 3rd of June.
Fantastic.
So looking forward to having the those guys play their books inspired suite of
they
songs.
Are we had them in the shop a couple of years ago, and they're fantastic, really. excellent musicians and good singers, but also all the songs are about books. What more could you ask for?
Absolutely, yeah. Lots of other stuff coming up. The Ballymillow Lit Fest, which is coming up on between May 20th and 22nd at Ballymillow Cookery Schools. It's the big line of speakers there. Lots on food, but there aren't really at all as well. The Stole Writers Week then at the end of the month or the start of June. We give it a quick mention now. We'll mention it again in our June our June edition. But that's taking place between June 1st and 5th in the Stole. And a couple of other things. Words on the Street, Bob?
Yeah, Words on the Street happens every year. Basically, 12 countries, 12 voices, 12 venues. So basically, it's European writing from 12 different countries being read by 12 different Irish celebrities or people, as it were, in 12 venues. And this year it's set in the Temple Bar area. So we'll be hosting one in the Gutter Bookshop, and there'll be various others. I think there's one in Smock Alley Theatre, etc., etc. So the first reading takes place at each venue at 6:30, and then they repeat them every 30 minutes until 8:30. The last reading starts at 8:30. It's completely free. Everyone's welcome to come along. You wander from venue to venue and hear some great new writing from various countries around. It's organised by Dublin City of Literature. So you just need to go on to DublinCityOfLiterature.ie to get all the information and a map.
And a little bit further on down the line, the quick note of advance word for Kate Tempest at the Writers at Smock Alley.
Yeah, so Kate Tempest is getting a lot of coverage at the minute, and we are delighted to welcome her into our Writers at Smock Alley type series, an occasional series we do when we get people over and we use the theatre next door. So she's going to be appearing there on Friday the 10th of June at 6 p.m. Tickets will be available from early May. We're just getting it set up at the minute. So I've said normally the 3rd of May you'll be able to get tickets from smockalley.com, and it's going to be charged at €7. Kate Tempest is well known as kind of one of the biggest lights in kind of spoken word in the UK and over here, and her first novel has just come out from Bloomsbury.
Yeah, and €7 would be value. I think there's a lot of literary events that might be €10, €15, €20, and I think €7 for Kate Tempest is certainly value.
I think it's going to be a great evening, and certainly one we expect to sell out quickly. So looking forward to that on the 10th of June.
And way down the line, looking way ahead down the year, we've Culture Night again is taking place in September, but the registration has opened. So I think culturenight.ie, you can go on there and register if you're interested in holding a Culture Night event. To the registration has opened for that over the last
always our favourite evening of the year, it has to be said.
That is just about it for this episode of Bookish. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We've got to the end of another show, and if you want to catch up on previous episodes, you'll find everything at castaway.media/bookish, and get in touch with us on Twitter. We always love people tweeting us, so get in touch with us at Bookish Podcast.
This was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.